Welcome to episode 51 of the podcast at Delphi.org. This is your host, Jim McKeith. This episode is being released on Wednesday, September 5th, 2012. It was actually recorded shortly after our last episode. I was talking with Nick Hodges, former Delphi product manager, Spirit of Delphi Award winner, and the development manager at Gateway Ticketing. The original intent was I was going to bunch a bunch of episodes together for the release of Delphi XE3, but that didn't happen, so now I'm just releasing this episode, which was a great one, with Nick and I discussing various things about Delphi development and what he's doing at Gateway Ticketing. So, hope you enjoy this episode, sorry for the delay, and sorry to Nick for keeping him waiting. That's right, you heard correctly, Delphi XE3 was just released yesterday. The Software Assurance subscribers, actually, I believe, were the first to get a hold of it. Actually, they had a hold of it before the GA, the general availability date, which was yesterday. And partners, I believe they got a hold of it yesterday as well. I got my copy and installed that. I'll be presenting on it at the Boise Software Developers Group, BSDG, tomorrow here in Boise. So if you're in my neck of the woods, swing by and say howdy. Things that are new in Delphi XE3, they added visual live bindings, which is a pretty cool technology that lets you visually create the live bindings. They also added support for SQLite. They also added, they're calling it Metropolis, which is a skinning for your Delphi apps to make them look like Windows 8 applications. So they look kind of like Windows 8 applications, and they behave kind of like Windows 8 applications. The app can't be distributed through the Windows Store, but they guess you can have a link in the Windows Store so it can come to your site and get it. So it's not actually using the WinRT, the Windows runtime, that is a regular, formerly called Metro app, would use. It's using existing Delphi, VCL, or FireMonkey. It just kind of looks like a Windows 8 application. The other big new feature they added was the FireMonkey. FireMonkey 2, as they're calling it, now has action support. Interestingly, though, they did take out support for mobile development. And there'll be more information coming on that in the future, but I believe there's going to be a separate IDE or separate tool that will be used for mobile development. I'm not sure what that's going to look like, but there will be news coming on that in the near future. So. Also coinciding with the XE3 release is the Oxygen 5.2, which is available as Prism. Comes in two different flavors. There's Oxygen for .NET, which is Prism, and then Oxygen for Java, which is a separate tool available just from RimObjects. You can actually get both of those right now on a special sale because we're also launching a new flavor of Oxygen called Nougat, which is going to be a version of Oxygen for creating iOS and Mac applications. It consumes Cocoa and Cocoa Touch natively, so it gives you that native developer experience and gives your users that native user experience because you're actually using the actual controls. Big new changes in Oxygen for .NET is it supports WinRT for creating actual Windows 8 applications that will run on the Windows runtime, deploy through the Windows Store, etc. A number of other IDE enhancements. The fixits even gotten even better. Lots of great new features there. Be sure and check it out. To do another podcast just to talk about all the new features in the new version of Oxygen. But go out there now and check out that special pricing, the promotional pricing for the release of Nougat. You can get all three versions of Oxygen for just a screaming deal. And if you've already owned one, you can upgrade it, add support for Android development, add support for iOS development to your XE3 app license. So check that out, rimobjects.com/shop. And now let's go ahead and start talking with Nick Hodges. Good morning, Nick. Welcome to the podcast at Delphi.org. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, you're very welcome. It's good to be here.
So you guys are keeping busy over there at Gateway Ticketing?
Yes, we are. It's a never-ending stream of software. We have a lot of very high-profile customers that everybody's heard of and probably attractions that they've visited. And they are constantly enhancing and updating the product. So we provide a lot of maintenance releases. We do a lot of customization and adding new features to the marketplace. So we are working hard and getting a lot done. And shipping software like software developers are supposed to, right? As Alan Bauer famously says, shipping is the biggest feature of all.
That's right. That's right. You know, it sounds a lot like I used to work for White Orbit up in Seattle, and we wrote this big software system in Delphi and had huge customers that everybody knew, all the TV stations, radio stations, and, you know, some of the big networks even.
Yep.
And they're all using software written in Delphi. And then interestingly found out that most of our competitors also use Delphi. It's kind of was the industry standard. And it seems like I've heard other ticketing companies also use Delphi.
Yeah. One of our main competitors is a Delphi shop, and which I think is interesting. You know, it, technically we're an ISV, but we do enough sort of consulting and customizations that we're kind of a VAR to our own ISV kind of thing. It's an interesting hybrid and makes for some interesting challenges. But it seems like in the ISV space in particular, there is a lot of Delphi going on. I mean, I remember back in the early days, you know, people viewed Delphi as a secret weapon because they could produce software a lot more quickly than the C++ guys could, and a lot more high quality and performant than the VB guys did. That was, you know, back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I think there's probably a lot of vertical stacks, you know, vertical markets that we don't know about that are all done in Delphi. It's not surprising to me that, say, Wide Orbit's competitors also use Delphi, and certainly ours do. So.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great tool for an ISV.
Yeah, that's kind of the niche I see it in a lot. A lot of enterprises have gone to .NET or Java, and but you still see a lot of the ISVs in that and then using Delphi.
Absolutely, yeah. But there's still enterprise work going on in Delphi, too. One of our biggest customers does a lot of work, public-facing work in Delphi. One of their premier applications at their attraction is written in Delphi as well. So, you know, it's still around.
Yeah, it is. So it's been – how long has it been since you've been with Embarcadero?
I left Embarcadero in July, so about 2 years now that I left, and I've been here at the Gateway since the beginning of September. So I'm coming up on, you know, just short of 2 years here at Gateway. So it's been a while, you know, kind of nutty.
Yeah, it Delphi has really been active, making a lot of changes and moving a lot of stuff happening since it moved to Embarcadero. So in the last 2 years, I mean, a lot's changed since you've left.
Oh yeah, the. FireMonkey, you know, what became FireMonkey was just nascent, you know, very early stages. When I left, you know, we were looking at sort of reviving Qlix and that framework, and it sort of became apparent that just was not where we wanted to go, you know, using Qt as the back end, and that just wasn't, it was pretty clear, it became pretty clear as we began working on it that that's not where we wanted to go. And so couple of the guys had some ideas and started sketching out thoughts about what a cross-platform framework would look like. And as you know, subsequent to my departure, you know, the FireMonkey, I guess it was, I forget the name of it before, but it was an existing product that actually turned out to be pretty much what the guys were designing in their heads. And so I guess they bought it, merged it, and it became FireMonkey. And you know, the rest is history at this point, but FireMonkey seems to be a pretty cool platform.
Is that something you guys are using there at Gateway System?
We are not. I actually haven't looked, you know, I haven't done much with FireMonkey myself. It's interesting sort of where my interests have headed. We're a VCL shop strictly. Mm-hmm. Well, and we do, you know, we have two of our major products are in Delphi. One is the main point of sale and data maintenance tool that is used to sell tickets and administer the system. Then we have a back end server that leverages things like Indy and XML to communicate between our web store, and our web store is done in ASP.NET and MVC and C#. And so We do have a back end tool. So Delphi is strong in both those areas, right? It's a back end server tool using sockets and Indy and XML encoding, messaging. And then the front end is all VCL based point of sale, order entry, you know, back office order entry kind of thing. And it's all VCL. And you know, that's not to denigrate FireMonkey. We don't have the higher end graphical needs that FireMonkey provides. Although I will say that we're certainly looking at cross platform, particularly to the mobile devices. And that is something we will be exploring. That if we were to put some kind of client on mobile devices, FireMonkey certainly would be a good choice for us to go to, say, the iPhone or the Android, and potentially even, you know, Windows Phone or, you know, Windows 8/Metro/Surface, whatever. Because I believe, you know, FireMonkey's headed, you know, FireMonkey's probably heading that direction too, right? There's no... The basic functionality of FireMonkey, of course, is it's just a complete abstraction above any particular platform. And so the underlying compiler could be anything. So I'd be curious to see where Embarcadero takes that.
Yeah. Now, you know, you can get the Windows Phone and Metro today with Prism, right?
Yes, you can. And I was just going to I was going to tee you up for that. I was going to say, and I know remote, I know that RAM Objects, you know, has got solutions on that side of the fence as well. So I was going to, you know, like tee that up for you to preach that.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I appreciate the intent.
Anytime.
Actually, so one question I do have though is, with the backend stuff, did you find yourself, got you guys moving to the 64-bit compiler? I know when I was at Wide Orbit that we were really looking forward to that because we were hitting some memory barriers with some of our backend servers.
Yeah, we haven't done that yet. We're currently on XE, and the plan is to migrate to XE3 sometime next year. When I got here, it was Delphi 2007, and then we did the big, you know, Unicode jump. And as you know, it was easier than anybody thought, but more challenging at the same time as you know, we've talked about, I guess it's less and less in importance to make the jump, but you know, we had 2.5 million lines of Delphi code here, and some of it stretching back 20 years, you know. And so there were some challenges, but you know, we got it done, and now we're on the XE. So we're looking forward to migrating to XE3 next year, where we can start exploring some of the new features. But we haven't jumped to the 64-bit compiler because that's on XE2, but we certainly are thinking about it and looking at it. You know, it's entirely possible that it could just be a simple recompile, and that would be cool. But yeah, 64-bit memory addressing would be nice on backend servers for sure.
So how was the Unicode migration for you guys?
As I said, it was challenging. It was okay. It took a while. It took a lot of effort, but it's certainly worth it, obviously. We had a lot of legacy code that still used short strings and a lot of record-based data storage. So those were a little bit challenging, but it wasn't impossible, and it wasn't something that we didn't feel worth doing. You know, we're an international company. I mean, we have customers all over the world, you know, China, Japan, Dubai. There's big customers in Dubai and things like that. So being completely Unicode enabled throughout the system was a big win for us. And just this, you know, getting XE, which is a superior product to 2007, was a big win as well. Mm-hmm. You know, we're exploring certain data snaps capabilities, REST server capabilities, and things inside the product as well. So we're looking forward to moving to XE3 next year. One of the things we want to be able to move to XE3, of course, is to be able to start using some of the mocking frameworks that are out there that take advantage of some of the new features of the language. And that's something we're really looking forward to too, because we want to continue to expand our unit testing, and certainly the Delphi Mox framework that Vince Perrette has built is a very powerful tool. We've looked at some others that may work in XE as well. So there's a lot of cool language features, and that's kind of what I was alluding to a little earlier, was that I'm finding as I get, you know, as I move forward in my Delphi experience, I spend a lot more time just doing the pure language stuff and a lot less time dropping components and doing visual things, which I think is interesting. One of the things we had implemented here about a year ago was we integrated the Delphi Spring container, inversion of control container, into our process. So we are doing a lot of inversion of control to try and decouple our code. And so I spent a lot of time looking at the Spring framework, you know, and the collections part of it and a bunch of different things that are in there that are very code-centric. And so I end up doing a lot of code. That's why I haven't spent a lot of time looking at FireMonkey, because I'm spending more and more time looking at, you know, how to write interface, how to get my team to write against interfaces as opposed to implementations, how to get them to write testable code. You know, if unit tests are hard to write, then you're not doing it right. That's what I tell them all the time. So,
mm-hmm. So what is inversion of control for people that don't know?
Well, inversion of control is basically the notion that a class, any given class, should ask for its dependencies, not create its own dependencies. So if you have it's a classic example. I don't know. If you have a class that needs a validator, right, of some sort, needs to validate something, you don't create a validator in your code. You say, take in the constructor an iValidator interface, so that when the code that's creating your class will provide you with a validator, and you just take the interface, and you don't care how the validation is done. You just know that the interface is implemented somehow. And that decouples your class from any particular validator. You may have an improved validator. You may have a different validator for different conditions. And so you don't care where the validator comes from or what kind of validator it is. You just know that you have a reference to it via an interface. And so you end up not having to link hard code yourself to any one particular validator. And so the control, they call it inversion of control, is because instead of, rather than you as a class owner or as the class writer don't control what validator is used, you invert the control and pass the control externally, pass that control out of your class via the access point of, say, your constructor, or by looking for a particular validator inside of the inversion of control container, which would provide one for you. And a real world example would be another thing, like say you have a validator and it validates, but then when you want to run a unit test, you want to run a true unit test. You can't depend on another class. A true unit test depends on no other external classes. So you would pass in a testing validator that maybe doesn't do anything, because you don't care about validation in your tests. You just care about the functionality of the class itself. So you just send in a blank validator that just validates everything automatically no matter what. Or you could pass in one that doesn't validate anything, so you can test your class, how it reacts to bad validations, that kind of thing.
And that's mocking objects at that point, right?
When you're doing that sort of thing. Yeah, yeah. But the point being that if you hard code a validator into your, you go my validator gets t my validator.create in your code. If you do that, then you're locked into that t my validator. You can't pass in a testing validator or a different validator. You're locked and you're coupled to it. So inversion of control makes it so that you don't couple yourself to any particular implementation, and that you only couple yourself to an interface, which is like sort of like, as I say, sort of like grabbing at smoke, right? What is an interface other than just sort of this empty smoke-like code that you call and you don't really know how it's going to work? But you know it does. You trust that it does. The implementation will do what it needs to do.
It's one of those things when you go to using inversion control, it there's a little bit of growing pain going through that, you know, because you're used to doing it the old way. But then once we start doing it the new way, it opens us up to better unit testing and much more robust code and stuff like that. And it's just, it's sometimes we have these learning periods that are rough, but then the results are always so much better.
Oh, yeah. I cannot stress enough how much inversion of control will improve the quality of your code. It's staggering, really. And I got guys, you know, my team, we started using it. One of our really good developers came in and he goes, I can't believe how easy it is to write unit tests now, because you're decoupling your code. You're isolating every class and you can test each class individually. And then you can do integration testing if you want to by, you know, passing in a real database connection or a real, you know, object, relational mapping object, you know, one of your ORM objects or whatever. Or you can pass in a testing one, or you can just pass in a stub that does nothing because you don't care about testing that particular feature. It's just brilliant. If people are not doing inversion of control, I strongly recommend that you start taking a look at it and doing it. Decoupling your code, isolating your classes, writing unit tests for your classes, that'll just revolutionize the quality and capabilities of your code.
And even for people that for some reason think they shouldn't be doing, aren't doing unit testing, having that decoupled code makes it so much easier to make changes in the future, because all of a sudden you're not having to change everywhere. You just pass in the updated, a new validator or whatever.
The classic case is, you know, you pull on the big toe on your left foot and your elbow flexes, right? You know, and you're like, how the heck did that happen? That's what happens in code, right? You make a change on this one module way over on the left side of your application, and it affects something way over on the right side of your application. Like, how the heck did that happen? And that's the kind of thing that happens in heavily coupled systems. So decoupling your systems so that each thing acts in isolation, and a change in one module cannot have any effect on the it isolates the change, you know, any change to a specific location, so that if you make a change and it affects something else, you can see very quickly how that change affected, and the bug is in your one class, and the bug inside one class never leaks out into another class. So you fix it in one place, and it fixes it all over.
Right.
With Delphi, the classic case is, you know, you end up, and any legacy system probably has this, is you end up with like these enormous uses clauses, right? A unit that has 50, 75, 100, 200 things in the uses clause. Well, now you're coupling in code from everywhere. And, you know, there's all kinds of dependencies. You might end up, like a perfect example would be, if you unit test something and it takes 500,000 lines of code to compile a single unit test, and you know you've got coupled code, right?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Because you add one thing into your uses clause, and then that just spreads out like weeds, you know, in your yard. And the next thing you know, each unit test takes 500,000 lines of code. That's a big problem. You know, that should reveal right away that you need to start decoupling and using inversion of control and reducing dependencies between modules. And the Spring Framework container does a great job of that. I put my pitch in for the free open source project Spring Framework. You can just type Delphi Spring Framework, or you can go to, I think it's springford.org. There's been a lot of really cool, good work being done in that project. I recommend everybody take a look at it.
So Spring Framework is originally it was Java, and then I think they had a .NET version, and now they have a Delphi version, right? So how similar is it to the other platforms, you know?
I think the concepts are all the same. Implementation is probably unique or very, you know, very Delphi specific. Spring was like the original version of control system, container and system. For Java, as you said, there's many others now that is, I hate to say it, sprung up, but you know, the name, I think the Delphi Spring Framework is the only similarity really between that and the Java one is the name. In fact, you know, the Java Spring Framework is very XML configuration specific, with the notion that you can change an XML file to change runtime behavior, which is, it's kind of cool, but that also becomes a very big configuration problem. You know, it could have just as easily been called, you know, Delphi, in, you know, service locator, or Delphi inversion of control process. But the thing I want to stress too, though, is there's more to the Delphi Spring Framework than just the inversion of control container. There's encryption libraries, hashing libraries, very nice set of collection, generic based collections, you know, your stacks, queues, dictionaries, linked lists, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot more in there than just the inversion of control container. But
okay, so it's not just an architectural thing, it's actually functionality, then, it sounds like.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's quite a bit in there that's really, really good. I'm encouraging my team to start using the collections, the generic collections lists in the Spring container, in the Spring project as well. You know, enumerators, iterators, the whole bit. It's really cool. IEnumerable, a really nice IEnumerable implementation, which is really cool. All the collections implement the IEnumerable interface, which I think, again, everybody should take a look at what IEnumerable is, what it does, and start using that. You know, it's really cool, really good stuff.
So I was going to ask if you're using anonymous types. It sounds like you are, or not anonymous types, but generics. Are you also doing stuff with anonymous types functionality?
We're using anonymous methods quite a bit. We just did a project for a transportation company that we used anonymous methods to inject functionality into a sort of a container class to define specific events that, sort of a subscriber controller model where you can add functionality in an existing process using anonymous methods, which was pretty cool architecture and it worked really well. And I was really proud of the developer that did that, Martin Minder. And it was pretty cool. It was kind of a bit of an experiment because we do have, a similar system in another module that uses, basic method pointers and event handlers and all that kind of thing. But it was kind of cool to see it being done with anonymous methods. I appreciated that. And, that's the kind of thing that Delphi can do today. And that's what I said, as I mentioned earlier, that's the kind of thing I'm really paying a lot of attention to is, sort of the code. User interfaces, there's a lot of cool stuff being done with that, both, and even in VCL, there's the DevExpress components and TMS components, do a lot, and other company Ray's components, of course, do really cool stuff with UI, but that's kind of not where I've been focusing on. I've been really taking a look more down in the code itself. And in other words, I take the tool palette. I have a desktop setup that doesn't have the tool palette and it doesn't have the object inspector, and I hardly ever use the object inspector anymore in the code that I'm doing and what I think about and how I look at code.
What things have changed in the Delphi language that you just could not live without anymore?
I would say generics right away. Just the generic collections alone, but, I've been exploring ways to use generic, the classic use case for generics is collections, the T list of T or the, T dictionary of TK, those are the classic cases. But once you start getting into it a little bit more, you start finding places in the real world where generics can really, really benefit you. I actually wrote an article on my blog at nickhodges.com to plug that. That talked about, just a very simple example of how even just using a generic entity ID type inside of a base class can enable you to do a lot of cool things with regard to collections and your actual class framework itself. The other thing that it's not a new language feature, but it's become so much more important is just the notion of using interfaces. I think I blogged again about the notion that if there's one thing that I would teach a young developer today, if I could only pick one thing to teach a young developer, it would be code against abstractions, not against implementations. In other words, always use interfaces, really is what it boils down to. Or, a lot of people like abstract classes, which is fine too, and those work well in certain situations. But in general, if you're coding against the implementation as opposed to a interface, and again, you're coupling yourself to a particular implementation rather than an interface, which can alter its implementation as things change, as situations change, as code changes.
So one thing that comes up when people do code against the interface, which I agree is a good idea, but is that, so let's say if I'm implementing a class and it takes I'm using a class that takes another class as a parameter. And so I'm using a tfoo and it takes a tbar. I'm like, okay, I know this takes a tbar. So I just construct a tbar, look at tbar. Okay. I know what this is, what these properties are in this because it's all descriptive here and I can pass that in. But if it takes an ibar, then I have to figure out what class implements an ibar. And so it's not as easy to discover for discovery when using code that maybe doesn't have documentation or the documentation isn't easily accessible. How do you see yourself overcoming that in what you're doing there?
Well, I would agree that that can become an issue, but I would argue that, yeah, it might be a little hard to discover, but once you discover it, you've created a very healthy relationship between those two things. I wrote an article, another blog called Never Create Anything, and that caused quite a stir, as I recall. The notion is that is that if you are using inversion of control properly and you're using your, say your, you know, your inversion of control container properly, you never will call create. You will, well, I should, never is a strong word, you know, obviously, but you, as a general rule, you're not going to create anything. You're going to ask the container for a interface implementation. And you can even ask the container for a specific type, like a production one or a testing one or a, you know, one that does this or one that does that or a green one or a blue one, whatever, however you want to use it. But you never actually create anything. You rely on the container to create instances of registered classes against specific interfaces. So if you have a iFoo that requires a iBar, you ask the container, hey, I need the production version of iBar, please pass it to me, and it will give it to you. You never call create. You just ask the container for it. And that's sort of the base principle of inversion of control. And the downside there, of course, is that, A, you have to have a class registered for that interface. And it is a bit more administrative work to keep track of what's registered and what isn't and you know, is something available for this interface. But it's so much healthier for your code to just keep interfaces, keep the construction of objects outside of your code. Because again, anytime you call create yourself, you're coupling yourself to a specific implementation. You want to avoid that.
So how do you, now you're the, like a development manager there at Gateway Ticketing?
I am. I'm the product development manager is my title. And I am in charge of all the Delphi developers, our web team doing C# developers, as well as our testing team, which tests the software.
How do you find, I'm not asking you to tell anything on any employees specifically, but how do you find it as far as trying to get a team of employees on board with programming a certain way? I've found at workplaces before where you have some guy that's got some crazy notion about the best way to do stuff, and whenever you end up with his code, you're always like, oh, not again.
Yeah. Well, I think there's two approaches. One is you have to be very persuasive. And it's easy to be, it's pretty easy to be persuasive when you're right, when you've got the correct notion and, you can show the clear benefits of doing things, quote, the right way, unquote. It's always good to be the boss advancing these ideas. You know, the real frustration to me would be sort of to be a mid-level or programmer who realizes that these are the things that need to be done, but your boss doesn't see the benefit of it. So I like to think that I'm a boss who sees the benefits of things like that. The other thing is, you know, we have a good team that recognizes good coding practices, and I haven't received a whole lot of resistance to the things we want to do. I think the benefits become pretty obvious pretty quickly. You know, we have a good team here, and I should plug that we are looking to add and augment to the team. If you are a Delphi developer who wants to work in an environment where all kinds of good things like inversion of control and unit testing and proper software development techniques are implemented and used, then we would be very interested in talking to you.
Cool. And so how would they get a hold of you?
You can email me at nickhodges@gmail.com. You can go to nickhodges.com and get a hold of me. You can email me at my work address at nhodges@gatewayticketing.com. Go to the careers page on www.gatewayticketing.com and look at the job listings there. We have what I consider a pretty good write-up on, you know, give you a good feel for who we are and what we're looking for here at Gateway. So don't hesitate to get in touch with me if you are interested in doing Delphi work. Now, I will caveat that by saying that we are not looking for remote workers, and we currently can't sponsor H-1B visa workers. But if you are amenable to living in beautiful Boyertown, Pennsylvania, just about an hour from Philly, we want to hear from you for sure, definitely. There's my plug.
I remember that big that commercial you did right when you first went to Gateway Ticketing, that YouTube video.
Yeah, that's there on the website. Yeah, that's still kind of embarrassing. Although nobody bugs me about T-Smile anymore. Everybody bugs me about that commercial. Yeah.
So if you want to get rid of the commercial, you just got to do something more embarrassing is what you're saying, huh?
That appears to be the pattern that I'm following. Yeah, so I don't know. But yeah, go take a look at that. That was a fun thing to do. One of the guys here is an amateur movie maker, and he made that. And it's a takeoff on an Intel ad. I don't know if you've seen the Intel ad.
But yeah. Yep.
But it was pretty fun.
Who was the Intel ad? It was the guy that invented USB or something like that,
wasn't
it?
Yeah. He walked into the break room, and everybody's all freaking out.
Now, of course, the difference in the Intel commercial versus your commercial is the Intel commercial used actors.
Yeah.
They did not actually use the real celebrity.
Yeah, everybody in that video is gateway people. Yeah, that's for sure.
So was that somebody's actual Kylix book that you signed?
It was, actually.
Yeah. Maybe not.
Maybe not. There might have been another book with that cover printed on it, but I actually have two of those Kylix books at home. I was digging, we're kind of doing a cleaning in our house, and I actually have two of those Kylix 2 books with my neighbor.
Oh, wow.
From back, and that was a lot. God, that was a long time. 10 years ago at least.
I was cleaning out a box of books, and I took them to the local users group, and it was some old Turbo Pascal books even, and I used to use strange things as bookmarks, like $20 bill or something like that. So I was going through all these books to make sure I didn't have any, you know, valuable bookmarks in there.
Yeah.
And one of the books had a Turbo Pascal version 1 floppy disk in it.
Sweet.
So I pulled that out. I saved that one.
Oh, yeah. One of the guys here used to work at Unisys years ago. He cut his teeth on Turbo Pascal 2.0 or something, and he dug those discs up and gave them to me. I need to take a picture and post that on my blog, because that is a classic. Yeah. There's a lot. We've been using, you know, Gateways was a 23-year-old company, and it was originally written, the original product way back in the day, it was written in Turbo Pascal. And so there's quite a bit of old stuff here in the building, and every once in a while I put on Facebook a picture of some book I see from back, way back, you know, Beach, Weiler, or some of the original Turbo Power stuff before Delphi even was released. Some of the old Borland toolkits and stuff. Pretty cool. It's pretty fun.
Yeah.
Old books.
You know, I did compiled a history of the Pascal programming language a while back.
Yeah, I seem to remember that. Yeah.
And one of the things I found that was really interesting is the UCSD Pascal, which was the big Pascal right before Turbo Pascal.
Uh huh.
Compiled to P code.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it was an interpreter. Well, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. It did P code. Yeah. I remember that.
Yep. And then Gosling, the guy that invented Java actually cites that UCSD Pascal was the big inspiration for the Java bytecode system, which of course then was the inspiration for the .NET framework.
Sure. Yeah. It all comes back to Pascal, is what you're trying to say.
Yeah. Exactly.
Awesome. That's cool. Yeah.
Do you guys, what version control system do you use? And do you have like a continuous integration system set up, or how does that work?
Yeah, we do. We, when I got here, we were using Visual Source Safe, which was, it's Visual Source Safe. And so that was one of the first things I did, actually, was migrate us to Mercurial. And we've been using Mercurial with great success. That's a big mind shift. That was a big mind shift for the team, was the notion that, you know, merging is not something to be feared, and branching is something that you should do as a matter of routine. And then we were using cruisecontrol.net, and that worked fairly well. But about a year ago, we migrated over to, Jenkins, which is the Hudson follow-on, which we really like, because you can farm out tasks, you can add build machines and network them together, and farm jobs out to specific machines, which is really cool. And we've used that with great success. We had a few growing pains along the way, kind of learning a little bit about Mercurial, learning a little bit about Jenkins, but we have a really solid system here, and we really enjoy doing continuous integration. You know, we do test builds every 30 minutes on any particular branch that we're building, and we do daily builds on our production releases every day, twice a day, actually. And, continuous integration, to me, that's a no-brainer. If you're not doing continuous integration, I'm not sure you can really call yourself a software development shop, because, the sooner you find a bug and the sooner you find an error, the easier and cheaper it is to fix. And you don't want errors perpetuating themselves. And continuous integration ensures that they don't. And you know, combining that with a system that allows you to merge changes forward very rapidly and easily and quickly means that you know, we can do maintenance on previous versions that our customers are running, but those fixes very quickly find their way into the most recent production versions for everybody. So it, I mean, it's a great system. And if you're not, again, if you're not using a distributed source control system, I would strongly recommend taking a look at one. If you're not doing continuous integration, you should start immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with that. We use Git here.
You're a Git shop. Yeah, sure. Very similar to Mercurial. Yeah.
Yeah. And we have it's kind of a homegrown continuous integration system that, If you chuck something into one of us, there's some branches that you can have your own branch that doesn't get continuous integration on. But if it's a develop or stable or master branch,
yeah,
or a branch off of those, it will build and test and give you the results, which is, it's kind of interesting for me because here I'm in Idaho and our build servers and everything are in Europe. And so, you know, I check in source code and it goes halfway across the globe and then I get a build report back from there and then download it again. So it's just an interesting round trip, the what happens there.
We use a Bitbucket for our code and that works really well for us. And so there's two advantages that we find with the distributed source control system. One is, you know, we can use a remote server, which is really cool. And so our code is always backed up. And then another thing people don't realize necessarily too is that when you use a distributed source control system, everybody's machine is a backup of the entire repository.
Yeah.
That's another thing. So, and plus with Bitbucket as our central server, you can work anywhere without having to be connected to a VPN, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So distributed source control systems are just so much superior in my mind to centralized systems that, if you're using a central system, and it's working for you, I guess, great. But you know, wow, the advantages of the distributed system are just immense, I think.
The whole merging branching thing is huge. What you can do with that, and
yeah, can't say enough about it. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like you said, there's a little learning on switching over, but once you do and you really understand what you can do with that system, it's gonna really improve the quality of what you're doing. I mean, I remember old systems, the non-distributed systems, where I'd have to fix something for an old version and then merge it into the next version. And I was using Beyond Compare, and you know, you have things up, and it was a whole day process to try and get it all back together right. And
yeah, we forward integration. The amount of time we spend doing forward integration is almost trivial compared to what it was with Visual Studio or Visual Source Safe, I should say.
Yeah,
I mean, that was a big problem. And it's tempting to forget or not do it correctly, or it happens. Now it just happens so naturally that you never forget to forward integrate something because you almost can't. You know, it's vastly superior system in my mind. But that's just one man's opinion, I guess.
Yeah. There have been a lot of people that have certainly echoed that, and I would agree with it as well.
Yeah. To me, going from a server-based system to a distributed version control system would be a revelation along the lines of going from using zip files to back up your source to using a real version control system. You know, that it's that big of a leap. You know, the initial leap going from just having nothing to the first version control systems was a huge leap, even though they were centrally managed. Now, going to a distributed source control system to me is equally as big a leap from, you know, server-based to the distributed.
Mm-hmm. And one thing some people seem to not get about distributed version control systems is usually you will still have a master copy somewhere, a master server.
Right.
But then you, so.
Yeah, Bitbucket serves that for us, but certainly you can set up your own if you want to, or some people buffer Bitbucket, like they have a master server that everybody in the business, internally that everybody in the organization uses, and that master server just backs up or coordinates with Bitbucket, but it still becomes sort of the central repository where everybody talks to.
Yep.
So it's a server in a sense, but you can, you know, a team can set up their own little mini server, you know, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Their own, they can take a branch and do their work on their branch and just continually merge the main branch into their branch. And then when they're ready, they can merge their branch back into the main branch. You know, it just works so well. It is a bit of a mind shift and a totally different way of thinking, big brain shift. But once you get it, man, it's so worth it.
And it really goes in well with the continuous integration because of the fact I can check in code to my local repository. And then as soon as I do a push, that's when the continuous integration occurs.
Right.
So then it's not, I'm able to commit frequently locally.
Correct.
And then I'm like, okay.
Yeah, that was a hard
thing for
my guys to do too. Just commit every 5 minutes, you know, commit all the time and have lots and lots of little discrete commits because then you can see the progression. You can regress back to a specific point if something doesn't go well. Create a branch to try something, and if you don't like it, close, you know, get rid of it. Don't commit it, you know, whatever. You have a lot more control, and it works the way that you want version control to work, not the way that systems kind of force you to work. And we have merge conflicts occasionally. I had one this morning, but we worked it out, and it was no big deal. It took 20 minutes maybe. That happens. The more you commit, the less that happens, of course, right? So.
Yeah. Yeah. When someone holds on to code for too long is when you get those.
Yeah, you don't want that. You don't want people holding on to code, right? Oh, well. So if you haven't gotten the message out there that you should be looking at source control, I strongly recommend you do.
I love programming language, you know, at the language level, like you said, you're working at, and the working with like branching and merging and just that level of granularity. What do you see as the future of that? Where do you see things going?
Well, I don't know. I guess I haven't thought about that too much. I definitely see these tools enabling distributed teams, right? I mean, and that's already happening. I would say that code has become, since I started using Delphi 1, code has become more important than, say like user interface. User interface is dreadfully and desperately important, but it's almost at the point where we've designed our system such that the user interface could almost be handled by a non-developer, a non-coder or developer, rather than by somebody who is more of a designer. Mm-hmm. One of the positions we're actually looking for is this notion of a web designer as opposed to a web developer. That is, a person who is very, very capable in the world of JavaScript, jQuery, CSS, HTML. In other words, web client-side development. Now, those, you know, certainly that skill needs a coder/developer capability, but it's a distinct skill as opposed to, say, a C# developer who is writing the back end of the web store, of a web, you know, we call web store, sorry, the, you know, a website or a web app, whatever. And there's a distinction between the two of those positions, and it's less true in the Delphi world, right? Where, I don't think as much there are people who do the equivalent client design. You know, that generally tends to fall to straight up developers. But I can see, even on the desktop/client side, non-web client side, where the notion of decoupling your code such that there's a very thin connection between the business layer and the UI would enable UI developers even on the desktop with Delphi. Like I could foresee the notion that there would be like this kind of person who didn't necessarily know a whole lot about Delphi development, but who would certainly be the one who would very easily create a user interface, and the user interface experience is very, very powerful, and have that very thin connection to the actual server side business logic kind of thing. Does that make any sense? Am I babbling?
Yeah, I totally agree. When I worked at White Orbit, we had a system that was written in Silverlight, and we had I can't remember what his title was, but he was a UI user interface designer that would do the XAML.
Exactly.
And we would then implement the code behind the scenes, and And it was actually really impressive because he would do things with the user interface and I would, you know, go to work on something and I would see the updated user interface and like, wow, you know, it's not that it's pretty necessarily only, but the, he would explain, you know, affordance and all this different terminology and what that means in a user interface. And it really made a huge difference in making the app more usable and making it appear to do what you expect it to do.
Yeah, it was MVC, right? I mean, MVC is, I mean,
yep.
You really, my guess is there's not a whole lot of people going file new web forms application at this point, right? They're going file new MVC for application. And, you know, that's very webby. When you say MVC, you almost immediately think of ASP.NET or, you know, some of the Java frameworks for the web. But, you know, those same MVC, MVVM, MVP, whatever acronym you want to use, principles should apply to the desktop as well. And it would be fun to see some frameworks start arising in Delphi that allow you to do more MVC kinds of things in Delphi. I mean, there is a really large amount of code out there where people drop a button, double click on the button, and write business logic in the on-click event handlers, right? You know, on programming. And that worked great, and Delphi really enabled that, but it was almost, you know, a blessing and a curse that it wrapped up into one, because now you just, man, that's just not how you want to do business, right? I mean, it's perfectly acceptable to have a button on click handler. You know, if you're going to click the button, it's got to do something. But basically, you just want it calling one line of code into your back end business objects and your back end business logic, right? You click the button and it calls, you know, my widget.process. And, you know, the linking between the interface and your middle tier or your business logic, you know, it might all be physically in the same place, but the actual linking is very thin, you know, model view controller, right? I mean,
right. Well, we actually have a in our data abstract, Room Objects Data Abstract, which for those that don't know is a multi-tier system, but we actually have our wizard will create a monolithic application for you. So you'll have the middle tier and the client in the same application. Uh-huh. So if you are like, well, I don't need the multi-tier stuff, but it gives you that nice encapsulation of, okay, here's the user interface, and then it calls the business logic, which is encapsulated in a separate tier, right, but then it's all in the same application.
Exactly.
So,
yeah. And yeah, it's the physical layout of the system doesn't really matter, right? It's just the logical layout. I mean, you might compile all those business objects and the user interface into a single executable, but as long as there's a thin layer between the two of them, then you've designed your code well, and you may someday be able to split, much more easily be able to split that out into a middle tier, say, you know.
Because
the user interface doesn't depend on anything other than, say, the interface is exposed by your business logic, whether they're in the same executable or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the communication link in process, out of process doesn't matter.
Well, and, you know, that's like you're talking about before with the inversion of controls. There's a bit of a learning curve, a bit of a mind shift.
Right.
But once you make that shift to decoupling the user interface from the business logic, it opens you up to so much more flexibility and robustness in the future.
It brings a tear to your eye, you know, the beauty of it, right?
Yeah.
That's what I tell my guys. You know, oh man, it's getting misty in here when they do it so beautifully like that.
Yeah. And it, especially when you're on like a good sized team, to be able to decouple that makes it easier for people to work on different parts of the system and make it easier to maintain.
Oh yeah. One of the things we did here was we split up into what we call code teams. Our product is so large that we kind of had to break it down into specific areas so that developers could focus on a smaller subset of our large code base. Mm-hmm. And one of the tasks the code teams have is to protect their code and, you know, defend it. And when I say that, I mean that, you know, do not allow another code team's code to poke around on your innards, you know. If another code team needs something from you, give them an interface and implement that interface for them and let them talk only to the interface. And, you know, that gets to the heart of inversion control, gets to the heart of decoupling, and it gets to the heart of clean code. Writing good, clean code is decoupled code. I mean, that's all there is to it. There's no two ways about it.
when you're saying defend yourself, I know sometimes I see code where it takes something as a parameter, for example, but doesn't ever check to see if it is what it says it is, right? So if it's if it's an actual object, it might be a null object, you know, and then you're accepting this and passing this into your innards and don't know if it's, you know, initialized properly or even exists.
Correct, yeah. And then the other thing that happens too is like sometimes the guy might open up one of your, somebody from another team might just open up one of your units and start writing code in the middle of it. And you're like, what, you know, whoa. What are you, what are you doing? Don't be changing the internals of my code. I want every module to be very thinly coupled together via interfaces only, right? If you need something, I'll expose an interface for you. Or if you need to add functionality, I'll create a subscriber method where you can plug in your functionality into my system, as opposed to just going in and hard coding functionality into any particular method of a given object.
Yep.
It's really cool when you start thinking that way and writing code that way. It radically improves your system. And of course, you've got, you know, old legacy systems that aren't written that way, and you got to figure out ways to try and wrap those up using interfaces or refactor it to simplify and define more clearly the relationships between the modules.
Exactly. Okay. Well, hey, I think we probably ought to wrap up here.
Yeah.
Don't want to keep you any longer. You got busy over there and got stuff to do.
We do. I got to try and get a release out here today. So get a maintenance release out.
Cool. Well, thank you for your time, Nick. It's good talking to you again. And
I appreciate it very much. And again, if you're a Delphi developer or any kind of developer, you know, that's or a tester, we're looking for testers as well who, you know, want to work in an environment where we are trying to do things the right way, please let me know. NickHodges@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Or NickHodges.com.
So what's it like over in – I've never lived over in that neck of the woods. What's it like living there?
Eastern Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
Rolling hills, a lot of trees, a lot of green. You know, it's a little hot and humid in the summer. Fairly mild winters, you know, snow, that kind of thing. But it's beautiful. It's just gorgeous here. A lot of farmland. We are not so far out in the middle of nowhere that we don't have a Best Buy and a nice big Cineplex and, you know, a mall and all that good stuff. But, and we're close, you know, we're 45 minutes to an hour away from downtown Philadelphia. But we have a nice small town field here in Boyertown area, and it's really nice. I really like it here.
Cool. Excellent. Well, good luck. I hope you guys get some good Delphi developers and add to your team, and appreciate your time. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Jamie. Take care.
Thanks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the podcast at Delphi.org. We open with a little news about what's new in Delphi XE3 and Oxygen 5.2. Different flavors now, which is really exciting. But this wasn't our What's New episode. Hopefully we'll have some more episodes talking about what's new in the various fabulous development tools we get the privilege of using. Until next time, this is Jim McKee for the podcast at Delphi.org. Music by Kevin MacLeod.